Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Shobana Xavier. In each new episode, we have an author of a new book in Islamic Studies, and we engage with them. In today's episode, we are joined by Harold Morales. Harold Morales, an associate professor of religion at Morgan State University, is the author of Latino and Muslim in America, Race, Religion, and the Making of a New Minority. Morales provides one of the first monograph studies on Latino Muslims in America through the use of rich ethnographic details of various Latino Muslim communities, groups, and individuals. Situated in the context of post-9/11 hyper-racialized experiences, Morales carefully lays out his interlocutors' powerful journeys of revision to Islam and how they form historical and cultural continuities, but also transformations, such as through evoking Islamic Spain, or Al-Andalus, or food cultures. With its intersection of race, ethnicity, religion, and media studies, Morales has made a formidable contribution to the study of Islam in America, but also broadly on American religious experiences. Now, without delay, here's my conversation with Harold Morales.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
It's a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies podcast to ask our guests to share something of their journey and what led to the writing of the book. And I wondered if you could do that for us today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess my journey started with my grandparents. My grandmother was a missionary in Guatemala and my grandfather was a church planter in Guatemala, both for the Assemblies of God, a Pentecostal Christian denomination. And they were deeply religious, came to the United States with their visa sponsored by a missionary that lived here. And then there was a big earthquake in Guatemala. My parents came over. They had my older brother at the time, was like 6 or 7 months old. And so they came and made their life here in the United States. But much of their connection back to their culture and heritage was at church. So they started going to churches here. And for me, growing up, religion was a deeply intertwined aspect of my life with both religion, spirituality, and my ethnic and cultural life. So at church is where we spoke Spanish. It's where we ate pupusas and plátanos fritos. It's where I went by Danielito. And at school, it was always Harold. And so I had kind of like this split world that I navigated. And I was very interested in unpacking that and better understanding those histories and the ways that race, ethnicity, and religion intertwine when I went to graduate school. And so my focus was going to be on Latinx religions. And while doing so, I was also very interested in looking at the way that new media technologies were impacting religion and religious practices and religious organizations. And so I started looking at the role of new media technologies and the development of Latinx religious groups and organizations. And while doing that research, I came across a group of Latino Muslims, as they identify, who were operating almost exclusively through internet technologies, websites, social media, and so forth. And so I became very fascinated. And as I started to dig a little bit deeper, found out that there wasn't much research done in that area. And with the advice of my advisors and with the support from various Latino Muslim communities, I proceeded with the work. And it's been extremely rewarding, illuminating. And I'm excited to share some of the findings with you all today.
Yeah, that's great. I wonder really when I was reading the book, I was thinking about your positionality and the way that you were navigating, because a lot of the work was ethnographic. You were engaging with people, meeting people, even though some was also on the media. I wonder if there were moments where your multiple identities, some of which you've just talked about, were, you know, as you navigated as an insider, an outsider, either ethnically or racially, religiously, if that was at all a difficult process for you, or what the broader methodological process was in terms of gathering data.
It was definitely difficult at first. And I read about experiencing a kind of vertigo while being in these communities, because so much of it was indeed familiar. And then at the same time, there was so much that I was unfamiliar with and that was new to me. When I first came to the Latino Muslim Association in Los Angeles, I felt very welcomed. I felt also like there was pan dulce, these sweetbreads from Mexico and Guatemala that they had, and they had coffee. And so we were all just hanging out and drinking coffee and eating sweetbread. And that was very familiar, very similar to what we would do at the churches that I grew up in. And there was a strong matriarchal component to the organization. Again, also very similar to my experiences growing up. So a lot of my Sunday school teachers were women. And likewise, in this organization, a lot of the leaders were women. There was like this close analysis and study of reading of and study of the text, of the sacred text, the Quran, which I could jump into and do very similar things because of my experiences. So there was a lot that was very familiar, and they were very welcoming, even though I wasn't a Muslim, because they were all speaking Spanish and I was speaking Spanish, and we had similar experiences, and there's a lot that we could discuss. So in one respect, I found a lot of things familiar and I was welcome as an insider. But on the other hand, there's always been this kind of disconnect between me as a researcher, positions me as an outsider from within the religious community, and also my unfamiliarity at the start with a lot of particularities of the tradition. So like the communal prayers was something that I experienced myself as a very unique and powerful experience, but that I needed work at learning, interpreting, and being able to discuss and conveying those kinds of experiences that I was not familiar with. So at the end, it was a very rewarding experience, but at the very beginning, it was difficult trying to figure out where the lines were, where I felt comfortable and where they felt comfortable, discussing things and sharing certain kinds of practices and so forth. And it was a relationship building process. And I've been working with Lalma for over 10 years at this point, and it's an ongoing relationship, and I'm still in communication with a lot of the people. And when I talk to them, one of the first things they'll ask me is, have I taken my Shahada yet? Have I become a Muslim yet? And my response is always kind of like, no, not yet. So I'm always like kind of open to the possibility, though it's not something that I'm interested in, but because this is an interest of theirs, right? So as a researcher within the lived religions approach, I've tried to stay as open as possible and approach the individuals in these communities as my teachers, as my guides in the process, rather than as subjects or objects of inquiry.
Thank you for sharing some of that fieldwork process, because it is quite intense when you go into that, you know, that moment and the difficulties of the day to day, especially when you're trying to capture liberal religions. And it's really, at the end of the day, as you say, relationships, right? It's relationship building. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good. Yeah. I wonder if we could get into some of the details. And I wanted to start off really by talking about, we're asking you about the idea of Latino Muslims. I know in your introduction, you spent some time talking about even how the use of Latino Muslims is problematic or there's limitations to it. And I wonder if you could share that with us and maybe why you use Latino instead of, as you just mentioned earlier, Latinx, as some theories are going towards. Was it because your interlocutors were utilizing that terminology, or there were other reasons?
Right, right. So as I was mentioning, the work developed as a relationship between several individuals, organizations, communities, and myself. So as an example, I was very interested in doing an analysis of the media productions and looking at issues regarding identity formation and so forth. That's where I came at the project initially. And a lot of the members in the community expressed disinterest in that kind of work and asked what they really wanted was a history of the organization. And so I thought that the best way to proceed is to have a little bit of both of our interests in it. And so I took as much as possible their input. Another good example is where I wanted to start the story with the Alianza Islamica in New York in the 1970s. One individual that I talked to said, well, the story doesn't start there. It starts in Al-Andalus. But hundreds of years before that, when Muslims lived in Spain and started to influence Spanish culture, which then influences culture and religion in Latin America, and then in the Latinx communities. So as much as possible, I tried to incorporate the ideas and beliefs and histories as they shared them. And the term that was most used to self-identify was Latino Muslim. And there were internal conversations, not about the X. And I tried to introduce the word with as many people as I could, and pointing out gender inequalities and also other important issues in terms of intersectionality, non-gender identifying individuals. And sometimes people would be open and receptive to that kind of conversation. But most often people would just resort back to the Latino Muslim. So more of the internal conversations that happened were around whether they should be called Hispanic Muslims or whether they should be called Muslim Latinos. So giving the religious component more significance or more priority than the ethnic identity. And a lot of people actually argued for dropping the Latino component altogether and just being referred to as Muslims or referring to themselves as Muslim. And so there were internal conversations, but the overwhelming majority of the people that I spoke to identified as Latino Muslim. And that's the reason why I chose to proceed in that fashion to reflect and respect their agency and their decision in that regard.
And I want to go back to, you just mentioned Al-Andalus, and your book is really kind of structured around these three broader historical waves. Did you want to situate those waves for us? And maybe we could get into some of the ones, especially the ones that focus on media, and you get into hip hop, food culture, and various aspects. So what were the kind of the three broader waves that you're situating for your readers, and why did you choose those waves? Right. Maybe because your interlocutors were utilizing them as well?
Yeah, so there was definitely discussions about eras or generations, so that like the first people would speak of a first generation, subsequent generations, the latest generation, or eras in terms of organizations coming into and out of existence. And I chose to describe the movements, these historical shifts in terms of waves, both in light of some of the conversations that I was having, but also in terms of some of the things that I was seeing regarding changes in organizational structures, visions, missions, activities, and so forth. And so the first wave I situate, there are Latino Muslim communities in the East Coast, mostly in New York, comprised of mostly Puerto Rican Muslims. And that a lot of their work is coming out of folks who had been working in the civil rights movement in a lot of different activist capacities and providing social services. And when they embrace Islam, seeking to do that with broader Muslim communities, but not finding that their Latino identity and their Spanish language is being welcomed. And then sometimes they find that they were discriminated against for that precise reason. And often we're told not to use Spanish at the mosque or at the organizational meetings, to not dress in whatever dress styles that they were donning, the particular different instances of that. And we're encouraged to dress as the rest of the group dressed instead. Oftentimes donning different particular ethnic immigrant garb from different places. And when doing so, they increasingly felt alienated, or at least that their heritage that they grew up in was alienated, and eventually decided. So the sort of crux of the impetus for a lot of this organizational structures initially, for the first wave at least, was a response to that alienation that they were feeling amongst broader Muslim communities, and wanting to create a space of their own. And initially, and for a while, and this still happens sometimes today, being accused of fostering divisions within the community, the Muslim community, the Ummah, and that they should not exist as a separate ethnic group, but that they should instead just try to inspire and bring about cohesion amongst the broader U.S. and global Muslim community. And so it is because of these critiques and because of the alienation they experienced that I I find that they started drawing on particular kinds of narratives to develop their identity as a distinct group. And so especially the narrative that connects them to the history of Al-Andalus. So one way of saying that their Latino culture and heritage need not be ostracized, eliminated from their Muslim communities, they argue, was that Latino culture is steeped within Muslim heritage and practices, that for a long time, again, Muslims were in what is now Spain, what was then known as Al-Andalus, and that they influenced the language, the cuisine, the art, the architecture, the way of life, family structures, and so forth. And so that Latino culture, they would argue, is very much, again, influenced by and part of Muslim. And so that rather than looking at the incompatibilities between them, they believe that looking at this history and this historical connection would help both Muslim communities and Latinx communities understand that there is more in common than they initially believe. And so this first wave develops out of this moment of desire to connect with broader groups, but also an experience of alienation and a response to that alienation by developing that strong narrative component. So then the second wave proceeds a little bit differently, whereas the first wave was dealing largely with these issues and providing social services for communities, AIDS awareness, providing GED programs, brokering truces, and this is mostly situated again in New York. The second wave expands across different locations in the United States and on the web with the advent of internet technologies. And the focus ceases to be so much on social services and providing these services for their communities, but instead on religious education. So learning the Quran, learning the practices, the organizations tend at this point from the 90s on to focus on kind of like Sunday school, and usually still held on Sundays, where people are learning about the different teachings within the Quran, the Hadith, the stories of the prophets, the sayings and deeds of the prophet, and learning about different rituals and how to bury people and what is permissible and what is not permissible, and a lot of these kinds of conversations, rather than focusing on social service or activism. The third wave, the final wave that I look at, I'm not sure if it is a third wave, but it's I see the seeds of a potential return and reimagining and redeveloping in new ways of the first wave, where there are a lot of Latino Muslim leaders now that are very well educated within the tradition, but are also seeing a need to respond to the moment, the historical moment right now, where there's increasing xenophobia against Muslims, and wanting to respond to this historical moment by becoming more active in politics, local and at the national level as well, wanting to raise awareness, but also wanting to address issues that rather than just wait for the government to step in and try to fix things, trying to address issues themselves at a grassroots level. And so I know LALMA, the Los Angeles Latino Muslim Association, has recently been involved in canvassing, getting people to sign up for voting, teaching people how to take their DMV written exam so they can get a license and drive around, teaching people about their rights if they're not documented. And so again, trying to provide services, but in a very new historical moment in new ways than had been done in the first wave. And I'm not sure, again, how much of this will develop across all of the Latino Muslim organizations in the United States. There's been attempts to try to create one umbrella organization for a while, and there's a more recent attempt. And we'll see if it's successful or not. But this also kind of links back up to an initial question that you brought up regarding my relationship with the work. It's mostly ethnographic, and yet there's interest. So if I did indeed build a relationship, it's been an interesting sort of process for me to try to develop where do I put that line between researcher and community member, right? So as a Latino, a Latinx myself, in some ways I identify with the group, and in other ways I disagree. And part of the book, the challenge was trying not to insert myself too much, but yet I when I look back at it, I see that I'm in certain places speaking directly to specific people in the community, and in other places I'm trying to like step back and just describe what's going on and try to analyze the context and so forth. But those are the waves that I see. I think Latino Muslims play a very important role in broader national conversations around race and religion, especially at this moment.
Absolutely. And I really want to kind of pick up on the last comment that you made. One of the interesting things that there's so many aspects of this book which are really fantastic and insightful and very necessary, I think, for our moment in time. But it was also interesting to think about kind of the development or the history of African-American Islam, right? And then also thinking it in lines where there were some similarities, some differences that I was noticing. Mm-hmm. And has there been, and you do allude to it sometimes in your book, in terms of, you know, how they've networked together, or how maybe the civil rights movements broadly or personalities have impacted certain figures within the Latino Muslim community as well. Was that something that came up a lot? And I think I'm thinking broadly also about hip hop, right? Your chapter on hip hop and Clash of Civilizations is really kind of bringing us to this moment of media and how the Latino Muslim community is responding in very in a difficult time, but also responding in different ways, right? So I know that's a lot that I just said, but I wonder if you wanted to pick up from there, or any particular aspect, maybe even the media component.
Yeah, well, to go back regarding the connections between Latinx and Black communities. Muslim communities. So definitely initially in the first wave with the Alianza Islamica, many of the members identified as Afro-Latino or as both Black and Latino. And so when many of the members first decided to embrace Islam, some embraced with the Nation of Islam, some with Ahmadiyya movements, with 5%er groups, with different Black Muslim communities and organizations that had been involved with civil rights movement. And it was inside of these communities, some of these communities, that several individuals felt like their Latinidad, their Latino ways of being, were not being appreciated. So there's an interesting sort of relationship initially, both this self-identifying as both and neither at the same time. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, there are individuals who struggle with this. And so both if you're trying to navigate in predominantly Black communities as an Afro-Latino, that your Latinidad may not be appreciated as much as if you were in a Latinx community. But then vice versa, if you're spending most of your time, these individuals will relate in Latinx communities, that their Afro or Black identity becomes an issue as well. And so there are tensions, not always, but sometimes between those lines. And so how individuals will navigate this is still a very complex and difficult issue for a lot of individuals. In terms of hip hop, there's a chapter where I look at Hamza Perez's work, and there's a film in particular, New Muslim Cool, that I look at that follows his life. So Hamza Perez, he embraces Islam, and one of his early religious mentors encourages him to continue with his music, with his hip hop, and tells him that it could be a form of dawah. And so rather than music, though, at that point, he starts referring to it as protest poetry. And again, as a form of dawah, a way of reaching out, of teaching other people about Islam and inviting them to Islam. And so in the film, it follows his his process as he's developing a lot of this protest poetry, sharing it with others, but also as he's connecting more with Black Muslim communities. And so he's both in the music industry, but also in his personal life, in his marriage, is increasingly trying to figure out what are the points of connections and what are the things that he needs to learn as he tries to build a family and a community around these different ethnic and racial groups. And so it does become an interesting way in which people who live out their lives, making it difficult for academics, researchers, and people that want to create and work with these theoretical concepts and levels that aren't always as clean as we would like, and they end up being very messy, right? So in the film, there's this one scene that I love where there's an MC that's introducing Hamza Perez and his brother Suleiman, the M team, the Mujahideen team, and is introducing them, and he says, "You're Puerto Rican, you're Muslim, you're a hip hop artist, you're a father, you work in as a chaplain." So he's just describing all these intersecting identities that we don't usually think of as coinciding in one individual. And that's exactly what's going on with Hamza, right? And that's exactly what's going on with all of us, that we're not just one individual. We don't just identify with one particularity, but that it's complex and oftentimes surprising. And that is humanity, right? It is a surprising sort of existence and way of being.
And really, I think that gives us a nice segue into the broader kind of issue that you're raising in terms of religious studies scholars for religious studies students, is, you know, the importance of thinking about race and ethnicity in the study of religion, not only in the context of, let's say, Latino Muslims or Black Muslims, but for everybody, right? And what those dynamics are, the messiness of that is, right? The fluidity. And so why is that so important to remember, and particularly in, I guess, in the political climate right now, unearthing these complexities, embracing kind of the messiness of it all?
Yeah, I mean, so like, I guess labels are helpful to a certain extent, but then the experience itself reveals that there's more to it. And so I think that's the importance of it. Whether the label is a positive or negative one, it flattens a lot of the reality that is so much more complex and rich. And so if we have there's this program that came out on Univision, and it was looking at Los Hispanos Detrás del Velo, the Hispanics Behind the Veil is the translation of the program. And it was a miniseries news program looking at Latino Muslims and their stories. In the very first scene that they have that's opening up, describes Latinos and Muslims like day and night, right? That there's these stark contrast between the two. And they try to characterize what these differences are. And they say Latinos, right? And they have a series of images and words to describe Latinos that include things like dancing, drinking, eating pork, the party, sensual, and all these things. And then they say, and then Muslims. And then all of a sudden they're in the mosque and they're praying and they're very solemn and respectful and serious. And so you have these images that are supposed to kind of exemplify what each of the categories are, Latino and Muslim, that are again like day and night, like the sun and the moon, stark contrasts. And so to whatever extent these labels help us to better understand things, oftentimes they also serve to flatten realities, to create these stereotypes that may or may not be true. And even if they are true, they're true in like superficial ways. And so they might be conversation starters. But again, it requires a lot more relationship building, deeper analysis. And so in terms of religious studies scholarship, my qualifying exams were all in Latinx religions. And then my subject, my subject of inquiry, the communities that I was going to work with, required me to look at other aspects. And so it doesn't matter how much research we do and how much preparation we do. When we start talking to people, we're going to be surprised, and we need to be open to that surprise. We need to be open to the unexpected, and to incorporate it, and not to try to stay fast in whatever our expectations were, and enforce the subjects and the individuals that we're working to become what we expected them to be, right? So we have to be flexible, fluid, open, and continue to learn, not position ourselves. And not position ourselves in these places of authority as if we're the experts, and we know a lot more about these individuals than they know about themselves. So I think that's that humility is an important component of the work as well.
Yeah. And I do want to get into, you know, some of the voices that carry your book, be it the different organizations such as Alanza, and, you know, kind of the narratives. What was, I know throughout the process, you talk about reversion as opposed to conversion. You know, what was the process for some of your interlocutors for perhaps wanting to revert to the tradition of Islam? And be it, you know, men or women, how are the experiences of women different than for males? What are the challenges that they've gone through?
Yeah. Yeah. So with the Alianza, I had the honor to work with Yaya Figueroa and Rahim Ocasio, who were two of the three co-founders, the surviving co-founders, along with Ibrahim Gonzalez, who passed away a few years ago. And they're incredible individuals who are, every time I talk to them, still very energized and looking for social justice and wanting to continue the work that they started back in the late 70s and early 80s. Again, very, very close to the ground, grassroots oriented. And they have amazing stories. So like Yaya had connected with the Young Lords, was very instrumental in brokering truces between different gangs, and very knowledgeable of Islamic law and history, and is very committed to trying to work with younger people, younger Latino Muslims, and try to get them to look at Muslim scholars from Spain and not just from Egypt or Arabia, Saudi Arabia, and some of these traditional madhabs, schools of Islamic teachings. And so wanting to help younger Latino Muslims figure out their own way of doing Islam or Islamidad. But Ibrahim, who passed away, is a very musical character, very very fluid in his identities, very, very much attracted to the spirituality. All three of them were attracted to the social justice component that they found in Islam, the way that they engaged and were introduced to it. But Yaga was, again, very interested in the social service and activism. And Ibrahim was very much interested in the spirituality of it. And not to say that the others weren't, but there was this very, very, very artistic and poetic attraction of his to Islam in that way. And Rahim is just a scholar. It's prolific in writing these essays for popular audiences and putting together a lot of the more scholarly literature in the Alianza newspapers. And now, more recently, the Alianza they've put together a blog, and both Yaya and Rahim are writing again for that. In Los Angeles, my first person that I worked with was Martha Galadari, who was a co-founder of LALMA, the Los Angeles Latino Muslim Association. And she learned about Islam while she was studying English. She's from Mexico. Her sister was a nun. And she talks about remembering people wearing hijabs or veils in Mexico when people would go to mass on Sundays. And so she's like, there's that point of connection as well, and very, very religious upbringing. But she was first introduced to Islam while she was learning English in England. And there was a group of Muslim men who, unlike everybody else, the way she relates it, everybody else was kind of disrespectful towards her as a woman. and that these individuals treated her differently. And she that was like a first impression that she thought like, oh, these men are very respectful toward me. And they're Muslim and there must be a connection. And they she stayed in contact with them beyond the course. And they told taught her a few phrases in Arabic, like inshallah, and the bismillah, the invocation, and invoking for God's help and presence. And she said when she came back, she started experiencing some difficulties, some personal difficulties, and she started repeating these Arabic phrases. And she says that they brought her a lot of comfort during these difficult times. And that to this day, she is convinced that they are powerful words. And so like, she'll even tell me like when I was interviewing for my current position, she said, don't forget to say the phrases, right? Do your bismillahs. And if you get it, you know, like, don't forget to tell God. So she's convinced that these words have power, these phrases have power. And because of that power, she decided to look more into it, more into the religion, and she started to talk to more people about it, and eventually decided to take her shahada and become a Muslim, to embrace Islam. And then increasingly, she found her and other folks as well, other women, started to connect and find out that that as women, they were sometimes asked by their by their partners, by their husbands who were raised as Muslims, to adopt the religion, or were encouraged to adopt the religion, in interesting ways that Martha now is convinced and teaches that exceed the requirements of the religion and move into the boundary of culture. And so for her, she sees a very clear division between religion and culture, and that oftentimes marriages exploit a lack of understanding in that regard, and try to convince women to start cooking a certain way, wearing clothes a certain way, speaking a certain way, organizing the household a certain way, and that this is part of the religion. And Martha will say, no, it's not. That's culture. You don't need to adopt that. If you become a Muslim, if you decide on your own to become a Muslim, those aren't things that you need to adopt. And so like, she'll say phrases like, I'm still a Latina, I still eat tortillas, I still cook tortillas, and I'm still a Muslim as well. Like, there's a compatibility between the two. There, you don't need to give up your Latinidad when you become a Muslim. And so she's found many, many women who do experience that kind of lack of understanding or misunderstanding, which she understands as a misunderstanding, and started the organization both to learn more about the Quran, but also to teach individuals about the differences between religion and culture. And there was another organization, Piedad, that had similar goals as well, to kind of reach out to women who were embracing Islam specifically, and try to help them navigate it, and help with issues regarding like domestic violence, regarding sort of patriarchal relationships, teaching them what, trying to teach them what they believed were the rights of women in Islam. And so again, trying to empower them in these ways. Yeah, and there's more recent people as well. So Lalma Cesar is gotten his chaplaincy degree, and so he did not go overseas to get his religious education, and did so here in Claremont, I believe. And so now he's sponsoring the community in Los Angeles. The community is usually, especially in the second wave, have operated largely in borrowed spaces, have met in borrowed spaces, and have had to navigate things regarding what the people who control those borrowed spaces believe Islam is, how it should be practiced, what the role of women should or should not be. And one way that they've navigated that is by having a scholar, a male scholar, sponsor the organization. And so They have exercised their agency and autonomy by selecting which scholars they believe align best with what they would like to practice and believe. And this allows them, so by having a male scholar that's recognized by the broader institution that they're borrowing spaces from, allows them to have some autonomy. But now with Cesar, who has been with the community for a long time, whose education was supported by the LALMA organization itself, is now able to act as a sponsoring sort of scholar. A very, very interesting sort of developments are in the horizon for LALMA and others as well.
I was curious if there are organizations, Latino Muslim organizations, that focus particularly on LGBTQ identities or individuals. I know it wasn't touched on in the book, but if there are organizations like that that exist.
There are individuals who will blog about it. The organizationally, though, it's still kind of a taboo subject, I found, and in the conversations that I've tried to raise, the conversations don't go very far. So I think that's something where the community definitely needs to have more discussion around. So that a lot of it has just been around race and gender. And I think moving forward, there absolutely need to be more conversations about the LGBTQIA issues and their own community members who may identify as such.
I wonder if I could ask what you're working on now in terms of your next project and what we can expect from you in the future.
I've got ongoing projects. So there's some graduate students that I've been talking to in terms of their work and giving them whatever assistance I can with their work on Latino Muslims or Latinx Muslims. And there's definitely a lot of interesting work going on in Latin America. So Camila Pastor is doing some fantastic research on Muslims in Mexico. There are people who are working on communities in Brazil and Argentina. And so a lot of exciting things. And I try to stay connected with that research as much as possible. I do presentations, and there's a blog article that I wrote that I would like to turn into an article at some point on Mayan Muslims in Chiapas, Mexico. But other than those projects and continuing to stay in touch with a lot of my guides throughout this process, my research is currently focusing on religion in cities. We're starting a new center here at Morgan State University. You can find more information at religionandcities.org. In that vein, my personal research will look at murals in the city of Baltimore, religious or spiritual murals in the city of Baltimore, and how they connect to issues of race and justice.
That sounds fantastic, and I look forward to future work. And I want to congratulate you again on a fantastic book. I very much enjoyed reading it and also speaking with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.